Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. It's Ask Me Anything, and there is exactly one line open, 888-318-7884. You can ask whatever you like. And I don't know. I lost my mind. I forgot. Jimmy told me it's 2 weeks in a row now. I didn't ask him about his podcast in the first hour. I know why it is. It's because the YouTube department here is like pushing me. Get a good solid question in the first hour, and then I get nervous and I get my question.
An opener question at the beginning of the first hour.
And then I'm like relieved that I got it out. And then I forget that Jimmy produces a lot of content, and I just blow right past it. So what dropped today on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World?
Well, today I presented on Mysterious World, I presented a talk that I actually gave earlier this summer at a Christian parapsychology conference. There are Christian parapsychologists. I'm one of them. And they have organizations, and one of them had a conference earlier this summer, and a bunch of people gave talks at it, and I gave one of the talks. The particular talk I gave was about spirit communication. Now, some people, as soon as they hear that phrase, their spider sense goes off. But let's think about this for a second. You know, is it okay for Christians to communicate with spirits? Well, Cy Kellett, in John chapter 4, Jesus has a conversation with the woman at the well, and he says God is something, and he wants people who worship him in something and in truth. What word goes in the place of something? God is...
I'm not even going to look this up. I'm just going to go by memory. Spirit.
Yeah, God is spirit, and he wants those who will worship him in spirit and in truth.
Yeah.
So, second question, Cy Kellett, yes. Is it okay to communicate with God?
It is. It's highly encouraged.
Yeah, like praying to him and stuff like that. And if he talks back and reveals himself to you, should you respond or should you stick your fingers in your ears and goes, la, 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 I'm not talking to you, God?
Do not do the latter. Discouraged by the church fathers.
Okay. Now, how about another kind of spirit? Because there are created spirits like angels. Is it okay to communicate with an angel? Like when Gabriel shows up to tell Mary she's going to be the mother of the Messiah, is it okay for Mary to communicate with Gabriel? Or should she stick her fingers in her ears and go, la, 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 I'm not going to communicate with you, Gabriel?
I actually know for a fact that everything Mary did is okay. Because she never did anything that's not okay.
So it was okay for Mary to communicate with an angelic spirit.
Right.
Okay. How about the spirits of departed humans, like saints? Can you communicate with saints, Cy Kellett?
I can, yes. Yeah,
you could ask them to intercede for you.
Exactly.
And let's suppose one of the saints shows up to you in a vision, like, you know, she actually had her body at this point, but let's suppose Mary showed up to you in a vision or some other saint, and they talk to you. Can you talk to them back, or do you have to stick your fingers in your ears and go, la, 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 I'm not talking to you?
The fingers in the ears, la, 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 is just strongly discouraged. It's okay to talk.
Yeah, okay. And then there's this passage in 1 John 4 where John says, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits and see whether they're of God. Okay, if a spirit shows up, what are you supposed to do according to 1 John 4, Cy Kellett?
Test them.
Can you test them if you stick your fingers in your ears and go, la, 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 I'm not talking to you?
You cannot. You cannot test them that way.
So we see that there are robust forms of spirit communication that are not only permitted but expected for Christians, including talking with spirits who you're not sure who they are, like the ones that 1 John 4 deals with, the ones you're supposed to test. So that was the substance of what my talk at the Christian Parapsychology Conference was, but there's lots more detail, and I go into other options, you know, possibilities that are there too, and what the Christian faith would have to say about them.
Oh, very, very good. Check it out at mysterious.fm. Or wherever you get your podcast, you can go or you can go to Jimmy's YouTube channel. It's up and running and very popular YouTube channel. Check out Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Hundreds of, I can say that for reals, hundreds of episodes now available.
And, almost 400. We've got episode 400 coming up in January.
Coming up on four. And so that, I guess that's about 4 years worth of work.
8 years worth of work, given that there's 50 weeks in a year.
Oh, yeah. That's what I meant. I don't know. Oh, man. Why do I... All right, we're going back. We're going on the phones while I lick my wounds. Rob is in Green Bay, Wisconsin, watching on YouTube. Thanks for starting us off this hour, Rob. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yes, good evening. Thank you, Cy and Jimmy, for taking my call, and may God truly bless you both.
Thank you.
I hope these are worthy questions. I just got two quick ones. One's on the Gospel of John, chapter 7. Where Jesus goes up to the Feast of the Tabernacles, and in the, verse 8 he says that he's not going to the feast, but then in verse 10 it says he goes up to the feast. So it almost appears like he told a fib, and I wanted to get some clarification on that so I can better explain that to people that might question me on that. And then my second question is much more important to me as a neophyte apologist. I would like to know if Jimmy has a single source for good typology from Old to New Testament, so that I really get a lot of motivation from seeing how God has written the his whole story of redemption throughout history, and I really like to share that with people. But the sources I've had are kind of fragmented, and it's hard to compile everything together.
Okay, well, let's deal with the second question first so I don't have to end on a disappointed note. The answer is I don't have such a resource I can recommend. The reason I don't is because I don't focus on typology. I mean, I'm aware of typology, and in particular, I'm aware of it when it is used and called out in the Bible, you know, like Jesus, or even not called out, but like Matthew presents Jesus as a fulfillment of Moses. He's like a greater Moses. And it's fair to point that out, but my focus is almost exclusively on typology that can be identified from the Bible alone. And the reason for that is because I'm a biblical student. I seek to interact with the Bible in a scholarly way, and this is something that the Bible clearly does. In fact, you know, terms like type appear in the Bible. So it's part of my biblical studies to know about that. But I don't use it, because you mentioned apologetics. I don't really use it in my apologetic work. I need to be able to answer questions about typology, but I don't go to people and say, here's this piece of typology and you ought to believe X because of that. Because as St. Thomas Aquinas pointed out, all of the typology operates in the Bible, operates in the spiritual sense of the text, and not the literal sense of the text. And you can't prove something to a person who doesn't already believe it by appealing to the spiritual sense of the text. It's better to do what I call bulletproof in your apologetics, which means not using the weaker arguments, only using the strong arguments, which are the ones that are directly based on the literal sense of the text. So Aquinas says, and I agree, you don't try to prove doctrine by appealing to the spiritual sense of the text. There can be value in exploring the spiritual sense of the text, including typology that it contains, but it's not something I recommend for apologists to do. If you want to study typology because you're interested in it and you like discussing it with other people, that's great. I just don't have a resource I can recommend, because I have to prioritize what do I study, and that's not of value for my work as an apologist, because I need to stick to arguing based on the literal sense of the text in order to convince people of things they're not yet convinced of. For people who are already convinced of something, typology can serve as a reinforcement, but it's much harder to prove something if it's part of the spiritual sense of a text and is thus debatable. So I'm sorry I have a disappointing answer on that question, but that's where I'm at on that. When it comes to your when it comes to your first question, so you're right that in John 7, 8, you know, there's this major Jewish feast, the Feast of Tabernacles or the Feast of Booths coming up, and Jesus's brethren recommend to him that he goes up to the feast and display himself. And in reply, he says, "You go up to the feast. I'm not going up to this feast, for my time is not yet fully come." But then two verses later, we read, "But after his brothers had gone up to the feast, then he also went up, not publicly, but in private." So how can we explain that? Well, there would be several possibilities. Three of them leap to mind. The first one would be the one that you mentioned, Jesus lied or told a fib, in your words. That's problematic because Jesus is the all-holy Son of God, and we wouldn't expect him to ever lie. Certainly, we wouldn't expect for him to use deception in a way that was morally illegitimate. And so if you wanted to defend the idea that Jesus told a fib here, you'd have to articulate some theory of fibbing that would allow him to do this without violating his holiness, and that's a tall order. So it doesn't look like this first option is too promising as an explanation. A second option, which would be better, would be to say Jesus changed his mind. Now, that of itself is going to cause some people to stumble, because isn't he the all-knowing, all-holy God who shouldn't have to change his mind? Well, in his divine mind, which is changeless and omniscient, sure. And in his divine mind, he wouldn't have actually changed it. But in his human mind, which is within time and does change, like when Luke says he grew in wisdom as a child, that implies some kind of change happening in Jesus's mind. Also, it's obvious other things are changing too, because at one moment he's directing his body with his human mind. He's directing his body to do one thing, and at another moment in his human mind, he's directing his body to do another thing. So there's clearly change going on in Jesus's mind. The question would be, can we come up with a theory that would allow him to change his mind about something like going up to the feast, so that originally he planned not to go to the feast, but then he did? And I think that there's at least a possibility here. It's more promising than the first theory, the lion theory that we looked at. I think there's a possibility here, at least a possibility of articulating such a theory, which would involve circumstances changing. That early on, when the brothers recommended that he go up to the feast, circumstances were such that it did not warrant him going up. But then later, circumstances changed and it did warrant him going up. And so that's a possible way of explaining why he would indicate one course of action and then ultimately following another course of action. It was because circumstances changed. The problem with this theory is there's nothing in the text to indicate that circumstances had changed. So that's a strike against this second theory, which brings up a third theory. The third theory is a mental reservation theory. And the idea here would be, when Jesus said he was not going to go up, he meant something different than what people took him to mean, that he mentally reserved part of what he was intending, and he just didn't disclose that. And what he meant by "I'm not going up" was, "I'm not going up publicly." And this third theory has a basis in the text, because in John 7:10, John includes, he calls out the fact that Jesus went up privately, not publicly. And the obvious reason textually why he would include that phrase would be to explain this apparent shift in behavior on Jesus's part. So when Jesus spoke to his brethren and said, "I'm not going up," what he meant was, "I am not going up publicly." But in fact, he was planning on going up privately. And it seems to me that that's the best explanation of the three we've covered, because it actually has traction. It has a basis in the text of John's gospel itself. If Jesus had just changed his mind or had been lying or something like that, then it's harder to see why John would have included this phrase about, but he went up privately, not publicly. John, like any author, expects us to relate that phrase to what has just come before, and its obvious meaning would seem to be, this explains why Jesus said one thing to his brethren but went up anyway. It's because he was mentally reserving the fact he was going to go up privately. He was not going to go up and make a huge spectacle of himself the way his brothers recommended. Now, he did, once he got there, end up making something of a spectacle of himself, but not in the full way that his brothers were anticipating, because as Jesus said, his time was not yet fully come. And so he reserved the final big reveal until his final visit to Jerusalem during his last Passover.
And I tell you what, Rob, I'm going to leave it there because I'm a little late for the break. We'll be right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily Mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at Magnificat.com.
This is Jim Pinto, director of EWTN Media Missionaries. EWTN Media Missionaries prayerfully take EWTN to parishes and the community through the print and electronic media we provide. You can help EWTN share the good news by becoming a media missionary. Visit EWTNmissionaries.com today and join us in sharing the eternal word with the world.
Jimmy Akin is our guest, and it's Ask Me Anything. You can ask him anything. You're going to have to wait for a line to open up. We've got them all full at the moment. And so back to the phones I will go. And we're going to Milton, Florida, where Alicia is listening on the Catholic Answers app. Welcome, Alicia. Got a question for Jimmy?
Yes, sir. Thank you. Hello, Jimmy.
Daddy.
I just had a question about intercession of the saints. I come from a Protestant background, a Baptist background, both me and my mm-hmm. husband, and we're coming into the church next month.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. But I had a question. I know about asking the saints to pray for you, and we're both okay with that. We both do it. But mm-hmm. I've noticed that sometimes prayers to the saints tend to go beyond just asking for prayer, but asking them to say, like, Saint Anthony to help you find something, or a guardian angel to protect you. It's not mm-hmm. just asking them to pray for you. So my question is, what is acceptable and what isn't?
Okay, well, what I would say would be unacceptable would be asking a saint to do something when we have good evidence that they don't do that thing. But as long as you understand the prayer in a way that is compatible with whatever God allows the saints to do, I don't think it matters particularly what words you use. For example, if someone says, Saint Anthony, help me find my lost car keys, then that can be understood in more than one way. It could be understood in terms of Saint Anthony, will you Saint Anthony, guide me to find my car keys, or it could be understood as Saint Anthony, will you help me find my car keys by asking God to help me find my car keys? And understood that way, there clearly wouldn't be any problem, because all you're doing is asking Saint Anthony to pray to God for you. Now, it so happens that God hadn't told us a lot about exactly what the saints are allowed to do in heaven. We know they're allowed to pray to him. That's something that even the Bible talks about. But because there are passages that talk about the heavenly saints praying to God, so we know they're allowed to do that. Whether they're allowed to do something else, like, you know, drop a little hint into your consciousness to say, hey, look under the couch or whatever to find your car keys, that's something we don't know whether God allows them to do or not. So I would say that as long as you're open to whatever God wants in this situation, whether he wants Saint Anthony to help you by praying to him, or whether he wants Saint Anthony to help you by telepathically giving you a hint that the car keys are under the couch, as long as you leave it up to God to decide what he wants to happen, you're submitting to God's will in this prayer, and therefore there's nothing wrong with the prayer. It would only be if you knew that something was not God's will and you prayed for it anyway, that it would become wrong. So as long as you're open to letting God fulfill this request, however God determines, you're fundamentally submitting to God's will, and I'm not seeing a problem with it, regardless of the specific language that's used, because language can be used in all kinds of different ways, and it frequently is not literal. We frequently use non-literal expressions all the time. So even if it sounds like you're asking Saint Anthony to do something himself, it doesn't have to be taken literally. Now, if you spelled it out, though, and said, Saint Anthony, help me find my car keys, I mean you, not God, well, okay, that's getting to be problematic, especially if you have evidence that God has not allowed Saint Anthony. But even if you didn't have that evidence, rejecting God's providence is a problem. And so a prayer like that would be problematic on those grounds.
Okay.
All right.
Also, I think there may be you mentioned guardian angels guarding us, and I think there may be a special exception for guardian angels in this regard, because if they're guardian angels, they should do guard duty. And so if you're saying guardian angel protect me, well, God may allow them to do that. That, you know, now they're not technically called guardian angels in scripture, so you could challenge it. You know, what Jesus says is the angels of these little ones never fail to see the face of my Father in heaven, which means they have guaranteed access to intercede with God. They have guaranteed access to God to intercede for those under their care. So you could say, by guardian angel protect me, you could, if God allows them to do guard duty, literally punch a demon in the face or whatever to keep him away from you. You know, your prayer can be understood that way, but it can also be understood in terms of the guardian angel prays for you, and that's how he guards you. So the situation with guardian angels may be a bit different than with human saints, but as long as you're open to letting God fulfill the request however God chooses, you're fundamentally submitting to God's will, and it's not going to be a problem.
Okay.
Okay. Yes, sir. Thank you.
All right. Dr. Carla Broussard put out a book this year called The Saints Pray for You. So if you would like a copy of that, I'd be happy to send you that. Just give us an address. We will send it off to you. Jimmy Akin, our guest. All right. Well, Jimmy, let me ask you this now that I got a minute here. What about the Jimmy Akin podcast? What's happening over there?
Well, this last week I had an episode come out on what is heresy. So that was this Monday's episode. People throw around the charge of heresy a lot these days, and mm-hmm. very clearly many of them do not understand what the term even means. So I talk about what it means and how to identify heresy, and there's actually a lot less heresy than you might think, because what heresy is a refusal to believe a dogma of the church, and there aren't as many dogmas as people think there are. Coming up on Mysterious World on the Jimmy Akin podcast this next Monday, I'm going to be looking at the synoptic problem, which is the question of how the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke are related to each other, because those three Gospels are very similar, and there needs to be some kind of explanation for why they're so similar compared to, say, John's Gospel. And that's what the synoptic problem is, and I go through the different options that have been proposed on it.
You really do have to visit the Jimmy Akin page or channel over there on YouTube. All kinds of great stuff, including the Jimmy Akin podcast. Right back with more questions on Catholic Answers Live.
Have you ever wondered about the mysterious, even obscure aspects of the Catholic faith? Dive into the Jimmy Akin podcast, where Jimmy brings together information from many fields as he pushes the boundaries of apologetics. Tune in today to the Jimmy Akin Podcast, Mysteries of the Faith, a highly entertaining, informative, and at times humorous show that will help you grow in your faith. Visit JimmyAkinPodcast.com today to subscribe.
Lots of people have big questions about Catholicism. It needs a big book of answers, and now it's got one. The Big Book of Catholic Answers is filled with helpful replies to more than 250 questions about the faith. Questions about God, salvation history, the Creed, the Bible, the list goes on and on. Order your copy of the Big Book of Catholic Answers today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world. But it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. There's the groove of music. Jimmy Akin's our guest, and you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. A couple lines just opened up, so I will encourage you to call. If you've got a question, you can ask Jimmy whatever you like today, 888-318-7884. Unfortunately, Carrie, who writes the ads for the show, has discovered ChatGPT. And I can guarantee, I think the prompt for today was write an ad in the Halloween spirit. Let's see if you think I got that right. Hey there, ghoul friend. Creep on over to shop.catholic.com because we're brewing up some spookalicious savings that'll raise the spirits of every book lover this Halloween. Get this, every last item in our haunted halls is on sale. Every Jimmy Akin book and all the other books. But beware, the deals don't rest in peace. We've got fresh sales rising from the rising from the grave. Every day, it's absolutely fantastic. So don't ghost us, friend. Fly over to shop.catholic.com before these deals vanish into the mist.
I think Carrie must be taking some kind of delight in you having to read that.
Who told him about ChatGPT? It's only a few years from retirement. No one had to tell him.
I assume the prompt wasn't in the Halloween spirit, but something like, shove in as many Halloween-related puns as you can.
That's probably right, yes. I particularly liked Fangtastic. I don't know why. I particularly liked Fangtastic. Oh, well, we'll see what he cooks up for next week.
You know what I was watching today a little bit of earlier? You may remember this. I'm sure that the other folks in the studio are less likely to. But you and I may have both seen this. Back when I was a kid, I remember when I was 5 years old, I would come home every day and watch a particular soap opera that was on the air.
Oh, I think I know what you
mean. And the soap opera was named Dark Shadows.
Yes.
It was it was billed as a gothic soap opera, but very quickly it started to involve vampires and Frankensteins and all kinds of other monsters. And so it was like, wow, come home from preschool and get to watch monsters on TV. Yeah. Of course I'm into that.
Yeah.
And just today, coincidentally, I happened to see a little bit of old Dark Shadows video. So that was kind of Halloween related. Yeah.
Yeah. They probably shot it on videotape that didn't hold up very well, I bet.
The quality is not modern, but you can still tell what's going on.
Dark Shadows.
You know, a lot of...
They lived in New England, I think.
The first season, it was set in the state of Maine.
Oh, yeah.
In Cullensport, Maine. And the original season in 1966, for almost a year, they were in black and white.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because daily television was the last thing. The daily shows were the last ones to flip over. Yeah. Do you remember how excited they would be? They'd put that little thing at the beginning of the show
in color.
Yeah.
Or in living color.
Living color, right. Yeah.
And one thing that was interesting about Dark Shadows is even though this was the late 60s and early 70s, I think it went off the air in 71. But it was early 70s, and pop culture really didn't have a lot of science fiction concepts in it, especially the housewives who stayed home and watched, you know, soap operas, but they included parallel universe storylines.
No way.
Yeah, really? They did. They didn't use a term like multiverse or parallel timeline, but what they did was they talked about like in the mansion that the soap opera, the main family in the soap opera was set in, you could go through it a certain way and end up in parallel time where events had unfolded differently. And it's just an alternate timeline or another timeline in the multiverse. Those phrases were not yet well known. So they talked about it as parallel time. And they were doing multiverse stories on Dark Shadows, on soap operas, you know? So that's pretty cool. In fact, when they got canceled, they were actually doing an extended parallel time story. So they ended up in parallel time and never got back home to main time.
Oh, no. Dark Shadows with 60s were so awesome. So much cool TV. I don't remember the name of the TV show, but there were... Land of the Giants, I think. I liked that.
Oh, yeah. That was where they, was that Irwin Allen?
Well, are they like they would have to answer a giant phone in one episode, get off of a giant chair in another episode. Yeah. Yeah, that was probably Irwin Allen, Towering
that
Inferno
thing. Go into another planet where everything was giant by comparison.
Everyone was the same. They were just giant.
Yeah.
888-318-7884. The number Natalie's up in Fullerton, California, watching on Facebook. Oh, Time Tunnel, too. Sorry, Natalie. I'll talk about that.
Oh, Time Tunnel was great.
Natalie, go ahead. I got excited.
Oh, my husband just handed me the phone.
Oh, okay.
What did you want me to say?
What's your question?
Oh, okay. I am I guess my husband calls me a Protestant. I didn't even really think I was a Protestant until I did some research.
Okay.
My husband is Catholic. My kids go to Catholic school. I'm surrounded by Catholics. My husband wants me to come Catholic. I'm okay. The Eucharist part, I mean, I do believe we kind of take it in remembrance, but I'm okay with it being like the body. That's a great thing if it really is true, right? The whole thing with Mary being sinless is hard for me to get past because I just feel like it's putting Mary on the same level as God because God is perfect.
Okay. Well, let's explore this idea a little bit. So right now, Mary's up in heaven, right? I mean, you don't think she went to hell, right, or anything?
Yeah, I think she's in heaven, absolutely. But, okay. That's for God to decide. But yes, absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so if we assume that Mary's in heaven, is she a sinner right now?
In heaven?
Yeah.
I think we're sinless in heaven.
Okay, so we're sinless in heaven. That would mean we're perfect, right?
In heaven, yeah.
In heaven, yeah. But I thought you said, and I'm not making fun of you here, I'm just trying to think through this issue with you. You know, didn't you say that only God is perfect?
Yeah, on earth, yes.
Absolutely. Okay, but God's not on earth.
Well, he did come to earth.
Well, in the incarnation he did. But so let me make one point, and then I'll move to the next part of this consideration. So okay. If Mary is sinless now, and because she's in heaven, and if she, how long has she been in heaven? When, what century did she go to heaven?
Oh, I don't know that.
Well, Jesus lived in which century?
I don't know that.
Oh, okay. Well, it's easy. It's the first century. That's how we date our years, is the first century is when Jesus lived, and of course when his mother Mary lived. You know, so she would have, given a normal human lifespan, she would have gone to heaven sometime in the first century. And that would mean, since it's now the 21st century, that Mary has been in heaven and thus sinless for about 2,000 years. So Mary has been sinless for 2,000 years, even on your own proposal. So any period of time that she was on earth is going to be very small compared to the last 2,000 years, because people don't live for even 100 years. So she's been sinless for the vast majority of the time she has existed. But you raise a good point about being on earth. Okay, let's talk about that. And here I'm going to pull in Cy Kellett for some additional assistance.
All right.
Cy Kellett, excluding Jesus.
Yes.
And excluding Mary.
Yes.
Can you think of anyone who ever, even temporarily, was sinless when they were on earth?
Angels?
Humans.
Oh, humans? Oh, man, I'm stumped here. Like little
baby.
Oh, Adam and
back.
Eve.
Yeah. Okay.
Sorry.
So God created Adam and Eve in a state where they had no sin. They later fell into sin, much to their shame and our detriment. But originally, they were in a state of perfection too. They didn't have to choose to sin. So, it's not the case that being perfect makes you equal to God. So, Natalie, was Adam equal to God?
That's a great point.
Yeah.
I think that's a great point.
Yeah.
But I still think, okay, great point. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yes, you're right. If people believe Mary was sinless, then maybe it doesn't put them on the same level of God. She doesn't have the power and stuff like that. So thank you.
Yep.
Because that actually made me feel a little bit better.
Good.
Still, though, why do some Catholics, which they do, I think, you know, some still don't believe that she was, you know, like human, right? And a lot of the Catholic Church believes she was sinless while she was a human. Can you explain that, the difference? And do you believe that the Church is divided on that, or is that like they all believe Mary was sinless while she was human here on earth?
Well, okay, I want to make sure I understand what you're asking, because I want to give you the best answer I can. The Catholic Church teaches in a very solemn way that Mary was sinless throughout her entire life, both on earth and in heaven. Now, there are Catholics who don't believe that, but there are also Catholics who are just cultural Catholics who don't believe any number of things. They may not even believe that Jesus rose from the dead, or that God is a Trinity, or things like that. And that's because people are imperfect, and sometimes they're badly educated in their faith. Sometimes they choose to reject doctrines that they've seen evidence for, but they just don't want to believe them. And that's not unique to the Catholic Church. That's, you know, every church. There are people who are members of the Presbyterian Church and the Baptist Church and the Pentecostal Church and every church who reject various teachings of their faith. And that applies to the Catholic Church just like any other, because we're all humans. But the Catholic Church wants to articulate what it understands the truth to be, and it has articulated or taught that Mary was, by God's grace, in order to make her a more fitting mother for Jesus, preserved her from every stain of sin. And not just to make her a more fitting mother for Jesus, but to show us what his grace can do with human nature. So it doesn't, it's not just something that is unique to Mary. He's going to make all of us free of sin. He's going to, I mean, at least if we die in God's friendship, we're not going to be sinners for eternity. God is going to make us just as holy as Mary. We're going to be just as pure. He's going to remove every stain of sin from our souls. And so we can look forward to that. And Mary gives us an example of what God's grace can do for us. So she's also a sign of hope, in addition to being a more fitting mother for the Son of God. Unfortunately, not everybody knows that or believes that, either because they were miseducated or because they've made choices they shouldn't. But that's the fundamental answer. Is that helpful, or did I not quite understand your question correctly?
Yeah, that's helpful. A last thing is, Mary was born sinless, but was Mary born of a sinner?
That's the standard understanding. The reason that Mary was the primary reason that Mary was born without sin was to make her a better mother for Jesus. But Mary is not the son or daughter of God herself, so she didn't need a parent who was sinless. And Jesus didn't need one either. I mean, God could have picked a prostitute and sent the world. He's omnipotent. He can do whatever he chooses. So he could have picked a sinful woman, a very sinful woman, but he chose to pick one who was holy and made holy in a special way by his grace, because it was more fitting to give the all-holy Son of God and a mother who had an extraordinary level of holiness too.
So in other words, she was kind of like an angel in a way, but human form.
Yeah, well, she was definitely human. She was just an exceptionally holy human.
Got it. And then the Catholic Church came up with this based on her being full of grace and just stuff that they found out in the Bible, right?
And also material that was passed down through the Church Fathers. We have Church Fathers reflecting on Mary's holiness very early on. In some documents that deal with that come from the first century, there are early Christian documents outside the New Testament, but they preserve ideas from the first century Christian community. And then as the Holy Spirit led the church into greater reflection, the church's understanding of these matters got deeper. For example, originally there was no term original sin. That term came later as people reflected on the idea of Adam's sin and how that relates to us. And then that then raised the question of, well, if Mary's very holy, is she subject to original sin the way we are? And the church was eventually led to conclude, no, that's inconsistent with the holiness that God gave her. So it's not just based on the Bible. There is additional information that was passed down from the apostolic community via what's known as apostolic tradition, or tradition that comes from the apostles.
Natalie, I wish we could just talk and keep answering questions. I have to take a break, but we can keep answering questions. We have a book from Jimmy Akin called A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist. And there's lots of questions with one-page answers in the book about the Catholic faith. I hope you will call again. But in the meantime, if you'd like the book, just hang on the line. We'll get an address and we will send it out to you and be to you next week. Got to take a break. Right back with more. Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin.
There's only one. Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
One of the reasons we should go to Mass is because, if you look in the Catechism, you will see the fruits of Holy Communion. And these are remarkable things that we can receive at every Mass that we attend. We encounter the risen Lord, and he shares something of his divine life and love with us.
The Holy Sacrifice of the Mass, live from the EWTN Chapel, every morning, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio and Television.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. I'm going to go straight to the phones, try to get as many on as I can. We'll start with Jeff in Indiana, listening on Catholic.com. Jeff, if you could be kind of quick with your question, we'll get you an answer.
Yeah, sure. So I was looking in the Moody Bible Commentary, and in their portion on John 6, the Bread of Life discourse, they mentioned that the phrase, "He who eats my flesh and drinks my blood," can't refer to the Eucharist or the Lord's Supper. And the first reason they give is because John paid very little attention to sacraments, and they mentioned that the Lord's Supper is never mentioned in his book. And I hadn't really encountered that before, so I wasn't really sure how to respond to that
okay.
from a Catholic perspective.
Well, I would say a couple of things. The first one is John is extraordinarily interested in the sacraments, especially baptism and the Eucharist. There are prominent discussions of both of these, one of them being John 6, but also earlier in John 3, we have a discussion, among other places, we have a discussion of baptism. The second thing, so I think it's simply a mistake to say John is not interested in these things. In the case of John 6, that's also assuming what you're trying to prove. But that's a problematic move, because there's a second fact about John's gospel that whoever made this comment is failing to take into account. And that is the fact that John has what I refer to as supplemental intent. John, unlike the three synoptic gospels, is written late. John clearly knows Mark, and he clearly not quite as clearly, knows Luke. He may have also known Matthew, but it's very clear he knows the synoptic tradition, because if you're, not only does the structure of his gospel interlock with the structure of the gospel of Mark, and I have, if you go to my website, jimmyakin.com, I have an essay there about that, but he also does refer to things that are part of the synoptic gospels that John mentions but never follows up on. Like early on, after the discussion of baptism, you know, John is talking about John the Baptist, and he says this was before John the Baptist was put in prison. And he never mentions John the Baptist being put in prison again. It's just this one little reference that he's dropped in out of the blue. And so what that tells us is John expects you to already know the synoptic tradition in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, where we're told about John the Baptist being put in prison. So it's like that's already out there, that's in the record, so John may refer to it, but he doesn't dwell on it because that story's already been told to the Christian community in the synoptic gospels. Also, we have at the end of John's gospel a reference to why he has included the specific material he has. He says it's to encourage belief, and he says Jesus did all kinds of stuff I'm not even talking about, and he hyperbolically says if they were all written down, I suspect the world would not contain the books that would have to be written. So there's a little bit what this fits with is a claim in the early church fathers that John was initially reluctant to write his gospel because Matthew, Mark, and Luke had already been written, but he was eventually persuaded to do it because he had knowledge that had not been recorded. And he's saying, hey, there's even more where there's no way I could record it all. So I did this selection to help you. Then there's the fact that the Gospels are all written to the same size. Scrolls, which was the standard form of book in the first century, have a maximum length. You can't bind, for example, the whole Bible in a book. If you did, then when you're halfway through, the two ends would be so heavy it would rip in the middle, and the book would be ruined. So books, in the form of scrolls, had a maximum length. And each of the four Gospels is designed to fill a scroll. What that means, and scrolls were fantastically expensive. Like a single copy of Matthew would cost the equivalent of more than $2,000 in today's money. So given that, you wanted to keep your biography of Jesus short and just to keep it to the size of one scroll, because even that's going to be phenomenally expensive. You're not going to get people, individual people, unless they're rich, to buy multi-scroll collections. And so that means there's price pressure to keep your gospel short, and that means there's pressure to leave out stuff that has already been written about so that you can include the new stuff, which is what John is trying to do. He is intending to supplement what's in the other Gospels. And that's why I say John has supplemental intent. Well, psych hell it.
Yes.
In the three synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, how many of them talk about the Last Supper and the Eucharist?
All three.
All three, yeah. So if from John's perspective, the institution of the Eucharist at the Last Supper has already been told to the Christian community three times. So what you don't need to spend space on is just repeating that story again. What you would want to do is go deeper into the theology of it and its significance for Christians, which is exactly what John is doing in John chapter 6. He's indicating Jesus is really serious about you've got to eat my flesh and drink my blood or you're not going to have life in you. This is not, so he's bringing out the significance of the Eucharist for Christians. And the idea that he could be using this language in it to have no relation with the Eucharist when Jesus himself introduced a ceremony into the Christian church that Jesus himself described as eating his flesh and drinking his blood, and someone wants to propose John 6 has no relationship to that, that is whack, as the kids used to say. And even most Christians, like Lutherans and Anglicans and Methodists, recognize that, yeah, Jesus is talking about the Eucharist in John 6. He's not repeating the institution narrative because that's already been told three times. John needs to keep his gospel to the size of one scroll. So what he wants to do is go deeper into the significance of the Eucharist for the Christian life rather than just repeat the institution narrative again.
What do you think? Oh, yeah. What do you think?
Yeah, that's perfect. That's kind of the route that I was thinking we would go. And I thought I had some rebuttals that a Protestant would probably bring up, but you answered those too. So I think that's good. I like that. Thank you.
Great.
Jimmy, I feel like I've read some of this. You wrote some of this at Jimmy Akin at your website or no?
I've written about John's supplemental intent.
Yeah. So, and that's, if I'm correct, jimmyakin.com.
Yeah.
Is that, yeah.
Yep.
Maybe check there, Jeff.
Yeah, frequent flyer there. Yep.
Your frequent flyer there. I don't know if you get any bonus miles for frequent use of jimmyakin.com, but thank you. I'll tell you what, I don't know if you're a frequent flyer there, you might have a daily defense, but if you don't have it, we'd be happy to send it to you. Just tell Edgar your address. A daily defense, 365 days plus one to becoming a better apologist, one of Jimmy Akin's many books. Jimmy, I certainly enjoyed the hour. Thank you, or 2 hours. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
I am kind of sorry that I reduced your work by half. on, I mean, I didn't reduce your, I reduced your credit by half on the amount of work you've done at Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. I'm sorry about that.
That's okay.
Check out Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, mysterious.fm, wherever you get your podcasts, or at Jimmy Akin's YouTube page. It's not page, right? It's channel. That's what we say now. And also, you'll find the Jimmy Akin podcast there. That will do it for us. We will see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.